This book contains up to 4 sides per cassette. Side 1, Gravity's Rainbow by Thomas Pynchon. Copyright 1973 by Thomas Pynchon. Narrated by George Guidel. This book contains 887 pages on 24 sides. If you would like to skip over any remaining announcements or introductory material, place your cassette player in fast forward until a beep is heard. Stop at that point to hear the beginning of the book. Annotation. A demanding novel of comic, terrifying incidents that traces the odyssey of the anti-hero, an American lieutenant stationed in London during World War II. Strong language and explicit descriptions of sex. 1973. From the Flyleaf. Of all modern anti-heroes, none surpasses Tyrone Slothrop, an American lieutenant stationed in London during World War II's Blitz. The lieutenant possesses a bizarre gift. His erections anticipate German rocket launchings. Discovered, he runs for it to escape being taken over as a pure instrument. He scrambles from London to the Riviera to Berlin, pursued by the Furies. Gradually, he becomes his own myth, known only as Rocket Man. About the author. Thomas Pynchon is known almost exclusively through his writing. In all other respects, he craves and guards his privacy. The public facts about his life are therefore few and far between. He was born in 1937 and attended Cornell University, where he published his first story, Mortality and Mercy in Vienna, in Epoch. Soon after leaving Cornell, he published 3 short stories, Under the Rose in Noble Savage No. 3, Entropy in the Kenyon Review, and Lowlands in New World Writing No. 16, which earned him an immediate reputation among the narrow but intense circle of short story readers. His novel, V, won the coveted William Faulkner Foundation First Novel Award in 1963. His second novel, The Crying of Lot 49, appeared in 1966. Since then, he has published The Secret Investigation in the Saturday Evening Post and An Essay of Los Angeles in the New York Times Magazine. Gravity's Rainbow, his third and most recent novel, was published in 1973 and won the National Book Award. For Richard Farina. 1. Beyond the Zero. Nature does not know extinction. All it knows is transformation. Everything science has taught me and continues to teach me strengthens my belief in the continuity of our spiritual existence after death. Werner von Braun. A screaming comes across the sky. It has happened before, but there is nothing to compare it to now. It is too late. The evacuation still proceeds, but it's all theater. There are no lights inside the cars, no light anywhere. Above him lift girders old as an iron queen and glass somewhere far above that would let the light of day through. But it's night. He's afraid of the way the glass will fall soon. It will be a spectacle, the fall of a crystal palace. But coming down in total blackout, without one glint of light, only great invisible crashing. Inside the carriage, which is built on several levels, he sits in velveteen darkness, with nothing to smoke, feeling metal nearer and farther rub and connect, steam escaping in puffs, a vibration in the carriage's frame, a poising, an uneasiness, all the others pressed in around, feeble ones, second sheep, all out of luck and time. Drunks, old veterans still in shock from ordnance 20 years obsolete, hustlers in city clothes, derelicts, exhausted women with more children than it seems could belong to anyone, stacked about among the rest of the things to be carried out to salvation. Only the nearer faces are visible to all, and at that only as half-silvered images in a viewfinder, green-stained VIP faces remembered behind bulletproof windows speeding through the city. They have begun to move. They pass in line, out of the main station, out of downtown, and begin pushing into older and more desolate parts of the city. Is this the way out? Faces turn to the windows, but no one dares ask, not out loud. Rain comes down. No, this is not a disentanglement from, but a progressive knotting into. They go in under archways, secret entrances of rotted concrete that only looked like loops of an underpass. certain trestles of blackened wood have moved slowly by overhead, and the smells begun of coal from days far to the past, smells of naphtha winters, of Sundays when no traffic came through, of the coral-like and mysteriously vital growth around the blind curves and out the lonely spurs, a sour smell of rolling stock absence, of maturing rust developing through those emptying days brilliant and deep, especially at dawn, with blue shadows to seal its passage, to try to bring events to absolute zero. And it is poorer the deeper they go. Ruinous secret cities of poor, places whose names he has never heard. The walls break down, the roofs get fewer, and so do the chances for light. The road, which ought to be opening out into a broader highway, instead has been getting narrower, more broken, cornering, tighter and tighter, until all at once, much too soon, they are under the final arch. Brakes grab and spring terribly. It is a judgment from which there is no appeal. The caravan has halted. It is the end of the line. All the evacuees are ordered out. They move slowly, but without resistance. Those marshaling them wear cockades the color of lead and do not speak. It is some vast, very old and dark hotel, an iron extension of the track and switchery by which they have come here. Globular lights, painted a dark green, hang from under the fancy iron eaves, unlit for centuries. The crowd moves without murmurs or coughing, down corridors straight and functional as warehouse aisles. Velvet black surfaces contain the movement. The smell is of old wood, of remote wings, empty all this time, just reopened to accommodate the rush of souls, of cold plaster where all the rats have died, only their ghosts, still as cave painting, fixed stubborn and luminous in the walls. The evacuees are taken in lots by elevator, a moving wood scaffold open on all sides, hoisted by old tarry ropes and cast-iron pulleys whose spokes are shaped like S's. At each brown floor, passengers move on and off. Thousands of these hushed rooms without light. Some wait alone. Some share their invisible rooms with others. Invisible, yes, what do the furnishings matter at this stage of things? Underfoot crunches the oldest of city dirt, last crystallizations of all the city had denied, threatened, lied to its children. Each has been hearing a voice, one he thought was talking only to him, say, "You didn't really believe you'd be saved. Come, we all know who we are by now. No one was ever going to take the trouble to save you, old fellow." There is no way out. Lie and wait. Lie still and be quiet. Screaming holds across the sky. When it comes, will it come in darkness or will it bring its own light? Will the light come before or after? But it is already light. How long has it been light? All this while, light has come percolating in, along with the cold morning air flowing now across his nipples. It has begun to reveal an assortment of drunken wastrels, some in uniform and some not, clutching empty or near-empty bottles, here draped over a chair, there huddled into a cold fireplace, or sprawled on various divans, unhoovered rugs and chaise longues down the different levels of the enormous room, snoring and wheezing at many rhythms, in self-renewing chorus as London light, winter and elastic light, grows between the faces of the mullioned windows, grows among the strata of last night's smoke, still hung, fading from the waxed beams of the ceiling. All these horizontal here, these comrades in arms, look just as rosy as a bunch of Dutch peasants dreaming of their certain resurrection in the next few minutes. His name is Captain Jeffrey Pirate Prentice. He is wrapped in a thick blanket, a tartan of orange, rust, and scarlet. His skull feels made of metal. Just above him, 12 feet overhead, Teddy Bloat is about to fall out of the minstrel's gallery, having chosen to collapse just at the spot where somebody in a grandiose fit weeks before had kicked out two of the ebony balusters. Now, in his stupor, Bloat has been inching through the opening, head, arms, and torso, until all that's keeping him up there is an empty champagne split in his hip pocket that's got hooked somehow. By now, Pirate has managed to sit up on his narrow bachelor bed and blink about. How awful. How bloody awful. Above him he hears cloth rip. The special operations executive has trained him to fast responses. He leaps off of the cot and kicks it rolling on its casters in Bloat's direction. Bloat, plummeting, hits square amidships with a great strum of bedsprings. One of the legs collapses. "Good morning," notes Pirate. Bloat smiles briefly and goes back to sleep, snuggling well into Pirate's blanket. Bloat is one of the co-tenants of the place, a maisonette erected last century, not far from the Chelsea embankment, by Corydon Throsp, an acquaintance of the Rossettis, who wore hair smocks and liked to cultivate pharmaceutical plants up on the roof, a tradition young Osby Feel has lately revived. A few of them hardy enough to survive fogs and frosts, but most returning as fragments of peculiar alkaloids to rooftop earth, along with manure from a trio of prize Wessex saddleback sows quartered there by Throsp's successor, and dead leaves off many decorative trees transplanted to the roof by later tenants, and the odd unstomachable meal thrown or vomited there by this or that sensitive epicurean. All got scumbled together, eventually, by the knives of the seasons, to an impasto feet thick of unbelievable black topsoil in which anything could grow, not the least being bananas. Pirate, driven to despair by the wartime banana shortage, decided to build a glass hothouse on the roof and persuade a friend who flew the Rio to Ascension to Fort Lamy Run to pinch him a sapling banana tree or two in exchange for a German camera, should Pirate happen across one on his next mission by parachute. Pirate has become famous for his banana breakfasts. Messmates throng here from all over England, even some who are allergic or outright hostile to bananas, just to watch for the politics of bacteria, the soil's stringing of rings and chains in nets only God can tell the meshes of, have seen the fruit thrive often to lengths of a foot and a half. Yes, amazing, but true. Pirate in the lavatory stands pissing without a thought in his head. Then he threads himself into a wool robe he wears inside out, so as to keep his cigarette pocket hidden, not that this works too well, and circling the warm bodies of friends makes his way to French windows, slides outside into the cold, groans as it hits the fillings in his teeth, climbs a spiral ladder ringing to the roof garden, and stands for a bit watching the river. The sun is still below the horizon. The day feels like rain, but for now the air is uncommonly clear. The great power station and the gas works beyond stand precisely. Crystals grown in morning's beaker, stacks, vents, towers, plumbing, gnarled emissions of steam and smoke. Pirate in a voiceless roar, watching his breath slip away over the parapets. Rooftops dance in the morning. His giant bananas cluster, radiant yellow, humid green. His companions below dream, drooling of a banana breakfast. This well-scrubbed day ought to be no worse than any... Will it? Far to the east, down in the pink sky, something has just sparked very brightly. A new star, nothing less noticeable. He leans on the parapet to watch. The brilliant point has already become a short, vertical white line. It must be somewhere out over the North Sea, at least that far. Ice fields below and a cold smear of sun. What is it? Nothing like this ever happens, but Pirate knows it, after all. He has seen it in a film just in the last fortnight. It's a vapor trail. Already a finger's width higher now, but not from an airplane. Airplanes are not launched vertically. This is the new and still most secret German rocket bomb. Incoming mail. Did he whisper that or only think it? He tightens the ragged belt of his robe. Well, the range of these things is supposed to be over 200 miles. You can't see a vapor trail 200 miles now, can you? Oh. Oh, yes, around the curve of the earth, farther east, the sun over there, just risen over in Holland, is striking the rocket's exhaust, drops and crystals, making them blaze clear across the sea. The white line abruptly has stopped its climb. That would be fuel cutoff, end of burning. What's their word? Brennschluss. We don't have one, or else it's classified. The bottom of the line, the original star, has already begun to vanish in red daybreak, but the racket will be here before Pirate sees the sunrise. The trail, smudged, slightly torn in two or three directions, hangs in the sky. Already the rocket, gone pure ballistic, has risen higher, but invisible now. Oughtn't he to be doing something? Get on to the operations room at Stanmore. They must have it on the channel radars. No, no time, really. Less than 5 minutes, Haig, to here. The time it takes to walk down to the tea shop on the corner. For light from the sun to reach the planet of love. No time at all. Run out in the street? Warn the others? Pick bananas. He trudges through black compost into the hothouse. He feels he's about to shit. The missile, 60 miles high, must be coming up on the peak of its trajectory by now, beginning its fall now. Truss work is pierced by daylight. Milky panes beam beneficently down. How could there be a winter, even this one, gray enough to age this iron that can sing in the wind, or cloud these windows that open into another season, however falsely preserved? Pirate looks at his watch. Nothing registers. The pores of his face are prickling. Emptying his mind, a commando trick, he steps into the wet heat of his bananery, sets about picking the ripest and the best, holding up the skirt of his robe to drop them in. Allowing himself to count only bananas, moving bare-legged among the pendulous bunches among these yellow chandeliers, this tropical twilight. Out into the winter again, the contrail is gone entirely from the sky. Pirate's sweat lies on his skin almost as cold as ice. He takes some time lighting a cigarette. He won't hear the thing come in. It travels faster than the speed of sound. The first news you get of it is the blast. Then, if you're still around, you hear the sound of it coming in. What if it should hit exactly? Ah, no. For a split second, you'd have to feel the very point with the terrible mass above strike the top of the skull. Pirate hunches his shoulders, bearing his bananas down the corkscrew ladder. Across a blue tile patio, in through a door to the kitchen. Routine. Plug-in American blending machine, one from Yank last summer, some poker game, table stakes, B.O.Q. somewhere in the north, never remember now. Chop several bananas into pieces, make coffee in urn, get can of milk from cooler, puree nanas in milk. Lovely. I would coat all the booze-corroded stomachs of England. Bit of marge, still smells all right, melt in skillet, peel more bananas, slice lengthwise, marge sizzling, in go long slices, light oven, whoomp, blow us all up someday, oh ha ha, yes, peeled whole bananas to go on broiler grill soon as it heats, find marshmallows, in staggers Teddy Bloat, with Pirate's blanket over his head, slips on a banana peel and falls on his ass. Kill myself, he mumbles. The Germans will do it for you. Guess what I saw from the roof? That V-2 on the way. A-4, yes. I watched it out the window about 10 minutes ago. Looked queer, didn't it? Haven't heard a thing since. Have you? It must have fallen short, out to sea or something. 10 minutes? Trying to read the time on his watch. At least. Bloat is sitting on the floor, working the banana peel into a pajama lapel for a boutonniere. Pirate goes to the phone and rings up Stanmore after all. Has to go through the usual long, long routine, but knows he's already stopped believing in the rocket he saw. God has plucked it for him out of its airless sky like a steel banana. Prettier, did you have anything like a pit from Holland a moment ago? Aha. Aha. Yes, we saw it. This could ruin a man's taste for sunrises. He rings off. They lost it over the coast. They're calling it premature Brennschluss. Cheer up, Teddy, crawling back toward the busted cot. There'll be more. Good old Bloat, always the positive word. Pirate, for a few seconds there, waiting to talk to Stanmore, was thinking, danger's over, banana breakfast is saved. But it's only a reprieve, isn't it? There will indeed be others, each just as likely to land on top of him. No one either side of the front knows exactly how many more. Will we have to stop watching the sky? Osby Feel stands in the minstrel's gallery, holding one of the biggest of Pirate's bananas, so that it protrudes out the fly of his striped pajama bottoms, stroking with his other hand a great jaundiced curve in triplets against 4-4 toward the ceiling. He acknowledges dawn with the following. Time to gather your arse up off the floor. Have a banana. Brush your teeth and go paddling off to war. Wave your hand to sleepy land. Kiss those dreams away. Tell Miss Grable you're not able, not till V.E. Day. Oh, everything'll be grand in City Street. Have a banana. Bubbly wine and girls with lips so sweet, but there's still the German or two to fight. So show us a smile that's shiny bright, and then, as we may have suggested once before, gather your blooming arse up off the floor. There's a second verse, but before he can get quite into it, Prancing Osby is leaped upon and thoroughly pummeled in part with his own stout banana by Bartley Gobbitch, De Coverley Pox, and Maurice Saxophone Reed, among others. In the kitchen, black market marshmallows slide languid into syrup atop Pirate's double boiler and soon begin thickly to bubble. Coffee brews. On a wooden pub sign, daringly taken one daylight raid by a drunken Bartley Gobbitch, across which still survives in intaglio the legend Snipe and Shaft, Teddy Bloat is mincing bananas with a great isosceles knife, from beneath whose nervous blade, Pirate with one hand shovels the blonde mash into waffle batter resilient with fresh hen's eggs, for which Osby Field has exchanged an equal number of golf balls, these being even rarer this winter than real eggs, other hand blending the fruit in, not over-vigorously, with a wire whisk, whilst surly Osby himself, sucking frequently at a half-pint milk bottle filled with vat 69 and water, tends to the bananas in the skillet and broiler. Near the exit to the blue patio, De Coverley Pox and Joaquin Stick stand by a concrete scale model of the Jungfrau, which some enthusiast back during the 20s spent a painstaking year modeling and casting before finding out it was too large to get out of any door, socking the slopes of the famous mountain with red rubber hot water bags full of ice cubes, the idea being to pulverize the ice for Pirates' banana frappes. With their night's growths of beard, matted hair, bloodshot eyes, miasmata of foul breath, De Coverley and Joaquin are wasted gods urging on a tardy glacier. Elsewhere in the maisonette, other drinking companions disentangle from blankets, one spilling wind from his, dreaming of a parachute, piss into bathroom sinks, look at themselves with dismay in concave shaving mirrors, slap water with no clear plan in mind onto heads of thinning hair, struggle into Sam Brown's, dub shoes against rain later in the day with hand muscles already weary of it, sing snatches of popular songs whose tunes they don't always know, lie, believing themselves warmed, in what patches of the new sunlight come between the mullions, begin tentatively to talk shop as a way of easing into whatever it is they'll have to be doing in less than an hour, lather necks and faces, yawn, pick their noses, search cabinets or bookcases for the hair of the dog that, not without provocation and much prior conditioning, bit them last night. Now there grows among all the rooms, replacing the night's old smoke, alcohol and sweat, the fragile, musaceous odor of breakfast. Flowery, permeating, surprising, more than the color of winter sunlight, taking over not so much through any brute pungency or volume as by the high intricacy to the weaving of its molecules, sharing the conjurer's secret by which, though it is not often death is told so clearly to fuck off, the living genetic chains prove even labyrinthine enough to preserve some human face down 10 or 20 generations. So the same assertion through structure allows this war morning's banana fragrance to meander, repossess, prevail. Is there any reason not to open every window and let the kind scent blanket all Chelsea? As a spell against falling objects. With a clattering of chairs, upended shell cases, benches and ottomans, Pirate's mob gather at the shores of the great refectory table. A southern island well across a tropic or two from chill Corydon Throsp's medieval fantasies, crowded now over the swirling dark grain of its walnut uplands with banana omelets, banana sandwiches, banana casseroles, mashed bananas molded in the shape of a British lion rampant, blended with eggs into batter for French toast, squeezed out a pastry nozzle across the quivering, creamy reaches of a banana blancmange to spell out the words, C'est magnifique, mais ce n'est pas la guerre, attributed to a French observer during the charge of the Light Brigade, which Pirate has appropriated as his motto. tall cruets of pale banana syrup to pour oozing over banana waffles, a giant glazed crock where diced bananas have been fermenting since the summer with wild honey and muscat raisins, up out of which this winter morning one now dips foam mugs full of banana mead. Banana croissant, and banana kreplach, and banana oatmeal, and banana jam, and banana bread, and bananas flamed in ancient brandy pirate brought back last year from a cellar in the Pyrenees, also containing a clandestine radio transmitter. The phone call, when it comes, rips easily across the room. The hangovers, the grab-assing, the clatter of dishes, the shop talk, the bitter chuckles like a rude metal double fart, and pirate knows it's got to be for him. Bloat, who's nearest, takes it, forkful of banane glacé, poised fashionably in the air. Pirate takes up a last dipper of mead, feels it go valving down his throat as if it's time in its summer tranquility, he swallows. Your employer? It's not fair, Pirate moans. I haven't even done me morning push-ups yet. The voice, which he's heard only once before, last year at a briefing, hands and face blackened, anonymous among a dozen other listeners, tells Pirate now there's a message addressed to him, waiting at Greenwich. It came over in a rather delightful way, the voice high-pitched and sullen. None of my friends are that clever. All my mail arrives by post. Do come collect it, won't you, Prentice? Receiver hits cradle a violent whack. Connection breaks, and now Pirate knows where this morning's rocket landed, and why there was no explosion. Incoming mail, indeed. He gazes through sunlight's buttresses, back down the refectory at the others, wallowing in their plentitude of bananas, thick palatals of their hunger lost somewhere in the stretch of morning between them and himself. 100 miles of it, so suddenly. Solitude, even among the meshes of this war, can, when it wishes, so take him by the blind gut and touch as now possessively. Pirates again some other side of a window, watching strangers eat breakfast. He's driven out, away, east over Vauxhall Bridge, in a dented green Lagonda by his Batman, a Corporal Wayne. The morning seems to grow colder the higher the sun rises. Clouds begin to gather after all. A crew of American sappers spills into the road, en route to clear some ruin nearby, singing, "It's colder than the nipple on a witch's tit, colder than a bucket of penguin shit, colder than the hairs of a polar bear's ass, colder than the frost on a champagne glass." No, they are making believe to be Narodnik, but I know they are of Yassi, of Kodrianu, his men, men of the League. They kill for him. They have oath. They try to kill me. Transylvanian Magyars. They know spells. At night they whisper. Well, here comes Pirate's condition creeping over him again when he's least expecting it as usual. Might as well mention here that much of what the dossiers call Pirate Prentice is a strange talent for, well, for getting inside the fantasies of others. Being able actually to take over the burden of managing them, in this case those of an exiled Romanian royalist who may prove needed in the very near future. It is a gift the firm has found uncommonly useful. At this time, mentally healthy leaders and other historical figures are indispensable. What better way to cup and bleed them of excess anxiety than to get someone to take over the running of their exhausting little daydreams for them? To live in the tame green lights of their tropical refuges, in the breezes through their cabanas, to drink their tall drinks, changing your seat to face the entrances of their public places, not letting their innocence suffer any more than it already has. To get their erections for them at the oncome of thoughts the doctors feel are inappropriate. Fear all that they cannot afford to fear. Remembering the word of PMS Blackett, you can't run a war on gusts of emotion. Just hum the nitwit little tune they taught you and try not to fuck up. Yes, I'm the fellow that's having other people's fantasies, suffering what they ought to be themselves. No matter if Gurley's on my knee, if Cruppingham Jones is late to tea, I don't even get to ask for whom the bells. Now over a lot of tubas and close harmony trombones, it never does seem to matter if there's danger, for danger's a roof I fell from long ago. I'll be out one day and never come back, Forget the bitter you owe me, Jack. Just piss on my grave and carry on the show. He will then actually skip to and fro with his knees high and twirling a walking stick with W.C. Fields' head, nose, top hat, and all for its knob, and surely capable of magic while the band plays a second chorus. Accompanying will be a phantasmagoria, a real one, rushing toward the screen, in over the heads of the audiences, on little tracks of an elegant Victorian cross-section resembling the profile of a chess knight, conceived fancifully but not vulgarly so, then rushing back out again, in and out, the images often changing scale so quickly, so unpredictably, that you're apt now and then to get a bit of lime green in with your rose, as they say. The scenes are highlights from Pirate's career as a fantasist surrogate, and go back to when he was carrying, everywhere he went, the mark of youthful folly, growing in an unmistakable mongoloid point right out of the middle of his head. He had known for a while that certain episodes he dreamed could not be his own. This wasn't through any rigorous daytime analysis of content, but just because he knew. But then came the day when he met, for the first time, the real owner of a dream he, Pirate, had had. It was by a drinking fountain in a park, a very long, neat row of benches, a feeling of sea just over a landscaped rim of small cypresses, gray crushed stone on the walks looking soft to sleep on as the brim of a fedora. And here comes this buttonless and drooling derelict, the one you are afraid of ever meeting, to pause and watch two girl guides trying to adjust the water pressure of the fountain. They bent over, unaware, the saucy darlings, of the fatal strips of white cotton knickers thus displayed, the undercurves of baby-fat little buttocks, a blow to the genital brain, however pixelated. The tramp laughed and pointed. He looked back at Pirate then and said something extraordinary. "Hey, girl guides, start pumping water. Your sound will be the sizzling night, eh?" Staring directly at no one but Pirate now. No more pretense. Well, Pirate had dreamed these very words morning before last, just before waking. They'd been part of the usual list of prizes in a competition grown crowded and perilous, out of some indoor intervention of charcoal streets. He couldn't remember that well. Scared out of his wits by now, he replied, "Go away, or I will call a policeman." It took care of the immediate problem for him, but sooner or later the time would come when someone else would find out his gift, someone to whom it mattered. He had a long-running fantasy of his own, rather a Eugène melodrama in which he would be abducted by an organization of dacoits or Sicilians and used for unspeakable purposes. In 1935, he had his first episode outside any condition of known sleep. It was during his Kipling period, beastly fuzzy-wuzzies far as eye could see, dracunculiasis and oriental sore rampant among the troops. No beer for a month, wireless being jammed by other powers who would be masters of these horrid blacks, God knows why, and all folklore broken down. No Cary Grant larking in and out, slipping elephant medicine in the punch bowls out here. Not even an Arab with a big greasy nose to perform on, as in that wistful classic every Tommy's heard. Small wonder that one fly-blown 4 in the afternoon, open-eyed, in the smell of rotting melon rinds, to the 77 millionth repetition of the outpost's only gramophone record, Sandy McPherson playing on his organ The Changing of the Guard, what should develop for Pirate here but a sumptuous oriental episode? Vaulting lazily and well over the fence and sneaking into town to the forbidden quarter, there to stumble into an orgy held by a messiah no one has quite recognized yet, and to know, as your eyes meet, that you are his John the Baptist, his Nathan of Gaza, that it is you who must convince him of his godhead, proclaim him to others, love him both profanely and in the name of what he is. It could be no one's fantasy but H.A. Loaf's. There is at least one Loaf in every outfit. It is Loaf who keeps forgetting that those of the Muslim faith are not keen on having snaps taken of them in the street. It is Loaf who borrows one's shirt, runs out of cigarettes, finds the illicit one in your pocket, and lights up in the canteen at high noon, where presently he is reeling about with a loose smile, addressing the sergeant commanding the Red Cap section by his Christian name. So, of course, when Pirate makes the mistake of verifying the fantasy with Loaf, it's not very long at all before higher echelons know about it, too. Into the dossier it goes, and eventually the firm, in their tireless search for negotiable skills, will summon him under Whitehall to observe him in his trances across the blue baize fields and the terrible paper gaming, his eyes rolled back into his head, reading old, glyptic old graffiti on his own sockets. The first few times, nothing clicked. The fantasies were okay, but belonged to nobody important. But the firm is patient, committed to the long run, as they are. At last, one proper Sherlock Holmes London evening, the unmistakable smell of gas came to Pirate from a dark street lamp, and out of the fog ahead materialized a giant, organ-like form. Carefully, black-shod, step by step, Pirate approached the thing. It began to slide forward to meet him over the cobblestones, slow as a snail, leaving behind some slime brightness of street wake that could not have been from fog. In the space between them was a crossover point, which Pirate, being a bit faster, reached first. He reeled back, in horror, back past the point, but such recognitions are not reversible. It was a giant adenoid, at least as big as St. Paul's, and growing hour by hour. London, perhaps all England, was in mortal peril. This lymphatic monster had once blocked the distinguished pharynx of Lord Blatherard Osmo, who at the time occupied the Novi Pazar desk at the Foreign Office, an obscure penance for the previous century of British policy on the Eastern question, for on this obscure sanjak had once hinged the entire fate of Europe. Nobody knows where it is on the map. Who'd ever think it could start such a flap? Each Montenegrin and Serbian, too, waiting for something right out of the blue. Oh, honey, pack up my Gladstone and brush off my suit, and then light me up my big fat cigar. If you want my address, it's that Orient Express to the Sanjak of Novi Pazar. Chorus line of quite nubile young women, naughtily attired in busbies and jackboots, dance around for a bit here, while in another quarter, Lord Blatherard Osmo proceeds to get assimilated by his own growing adenoid, some horrible transformation of cell plasma it is quite beyond Edwardian medicine to explain. Before long, top hats are littering the squares of Mayfair, cheap perfume hanging ownerless in the pub lights of the East End as the adenoid continues on its rampage, not swallowing up its victims at random. No, the fiendish adenoid has a master plan. It's choosing only certain personalities useful to it. There is a new election, a new preterition abroad in England here that throws the Home Office into hysterical and painful episodes of indecision. No one knows what to do. A half-hearted attempt is made to evacuate London. Black phaetons clatter in massive ant cortege over the trusswork bridges. Observer balloons are stationed in the sky. Got it in Hampstead Heath, just sitting breathing like, going in and out. Any sort of sound down there? Yes, it's horrible, like a stupendous nose sucking in snot. Wait, now it's beginning to... Oh, no! Oh, God, I can't describe it, it's so beast... The wire is snapped. The transmission ends. The balloon rises into the teal-blue daybreak. Teams come down from the Cavendish Laboratory to string the Heath with huge magnets, electric arc terminals, black iron control panels full of gauges and cranks. The army shows up in full battle gear with bombs full of the latest deadly gas. The adenoid is blasted, electric shocked, poisoned, changes color and shape here and there. Yellow fat nodes appear high over the trees before the flash powder cameras of the press. A hideous green pseudopod crawls toward the cordon of troops and suddenly, schlop, wipes out an entire observation post with a deluge of some disgusting orange mucus in which the unfortunate men are digested, not screaming, but actually laughing, enjoying themselves. Pirate Osmo's mission is to establish liaison with the adenoid. The situation is now stable. The adenoid occupies all of St. James's. The historic buildings are no more. Government offices have been relocated, but so dispersed that communication among them is highly uncertain. postmen are being snatched off their rounds by stiff, pimpled adenoid tentacles of fluorescent beige. Telegraph wires are apt to go down at any whim of the adenoid. Each morning, Lord Blatherard Osmo must put on his bowler and take his briefcase out to the adenoid to make his daily démarche. It is taking up so much of his time, he's begun to neglect Novi Pazar, and F.O. is worried. In the 30s balance of power, thinking was still quite strong. The diplomats were all down with Balkanosis. Spies with foreign hybrid names lurked in all the stations of the Ottoman rump. Code messages in a dozen Slavic tongues were being tattooed on bare upper lips, over which the operatives then grew mustaches to be shaved off only by authorized crypto officers, and skin then grafted over the messages by the firm's plastic surgeons. Their lips were palimpsests of secret flesh, scarred and unnaturally white, by which they all knew each other. Novi Pazar, anyhow, was still a quoi mystique on the palm of Europe, and F.O. finally decided to go to the firm for help. The firm knew just the man. Every day for 2.5 years, Pirate went out to visit the St. James adenoid. It nearly drove him crazy. Though he was able to develop a pigeon by which he and the adenoid could communicate, unfortunately he wasn't nasally equipped to make the sounds too well, and it got to be an awful chore. As the two of them snuffled back and forth, alienists in black seven-button suits, admirers of Dr. Freud, the adenoid clearly had no use for, stood on stepladders up against its loathsome grayish flank, shoveling the new wonder drug cocaine, bringing hods full of the white substance in relays up the ladders to smear on the throbbing gland creature and into the germ toxins bubbling nastily inside its crypts, with no visible effects at all. Though who knows how that adenoid felt, eh? But Lord Blatherard Osmo was able at last to devote all of his time to Novi Pazar. Early in 1939, he was discovered mysteriously suffocated in a bathtub full of tapioca pudding at the home of a certain Viscountess. Some have seen in this the hand of the firm. Months passed, World War II started, years passed. Nothing was heard from Novi Pazar. Pirate Prentice had saved Europe from the Balkan Armageddon the old men dreamed of, giddy in their beds with its grandeur, though not from World War II, of course. But by then the firm was allowing Pirate only tiny homeopathic doses of peace, just enough to keep his defenses up, but not enough for it to poison him. Teddy bloats on his lunch hour, but lunch today'll be ack, a soggy banana sandwich in wax paper, which he's packing inside his stylish kangaroo hide musette bag and threaded around the odd necessities. Midget spy camera, jar of mustache wax, tin of licorice, menthol and capsicum melloids for a mellow voice, gold-rim prescription sunglasses, General MacArthur style, twin silver hairbrushes, each in the shape of the flaming Shafe sword, which Mother had Gerard's make up for him and which he considers exquisite. His objective, this dripping winter noon, is a gray stone townhouse, neither large nor historic enough to figure in any guidebook, set back just out of sight of Grosvenor Square, somewhat off the official war routes and corridors about the capital. When the typewriters happen to pause, 8:20 and other mythical hours, and there are no flights of American bombers in the sky, and the motor traffic's not too heavy in Oxford Street, you can hear winter birds cheeping outside, busy at the feeders the girls have put up. Flagstones are slippery with mist. It is the dark, hard, tobacco-starved, headachy, sour-stomach middle of the day. A million bureaucrats are diligently plotting death, and some of them even know it. Many about now are already into the second or third pint of highball glass, which produces a certain desperate aura here. But Bloat, going in the sandbagged entrance, provisional pyramids erected to gratify curious gods' offspring indeed, can't feel a bit of it. He's too busy running through plausible excuses should he happen to get caught. Not that he will, you know. Girl at the main desk, gum-popping, good-natured, bespectacled ATS, waves him on upstairs. Damp woolen aides on the way to staff meetings, WCs, an hour or two of earnest drinking, nod, not really seeing him. He's a well-known face. What's his name's mate? Oxford chums, aren't they? That lieutenant works down the hall at Achtung. The old house has been subdivided by the slum makers of war. Achtung is Allied Clearing House, technical units, northern Germany. It's a stale smoke paper warren, at the moment nearly deserted, its black typewriters tall as grave markers. The floor is filthy lino, there are no windows, the electric light is yellow, cheap, merciless. Bloat looks into the office assigned to his old Jesus College friend, Lieutenant Oliver Tantivy Mucker Mafic. No one's about. Tantivy and the Yank are both at lunch. Good. Out with the old camera, then. On with the gooseneck lamp. Now aim the reflector just so. There must be cubicles like this all over the ETO. Only the three dingy, scuffed cream fiberboard walls and no ceiling of its own. Tantivy shares it with an American colleague, Lieutenant Tyrone Slothrop. The desks are at right angles, so there's no eye contact but by squeaking around some 90 degrees. Tantivy's desk is neat. Slothrop's is a god-awful mess. It hasn't been cleaned down to the original wood surface since 1942. Things have fallen roughly into layers over a base of bureaucratic smegma that sifts steadily to the bottom, made up of millions of tiny red and brown curls of rubber eraser, pencil shavings, dried tea or coffee stains, traces of sugar and household milk, much cigarette ash, very fine black debris picked and flung from typewriter ribbons, decomposing library paste, broken aspirins ground to powder. Then comes a scatter of paper clips, Zippo flints, rubber bands, staples, cigarette butts and crumpled packs, stray matches, pins, nubs of pens, stubs of pencils of all colors, including the hard-to-get heliotrope and raw umber, wooden coffee spoons, Thayer's slippery elm throat lozenges, sent by Slothrop's mother, Nalene, all the way from Massachusetts, bits of tape, string, chalk. Above that, a layer of forgotten memoranda, empty buff ration books, phone numbers, unanswered letters, tattered sheets of carbon paper, the scribbled ukulele chords to a dozen songs, including Johnny Doughboy Found a Rose in Ireland. He does have some rather snappy arrangements, Tantivy reports. He's a sort of American George Formby, if you can imagine such a thing, but Bloat's decided he'd rather not. An empty Kreml hair tonic bottle. Lost pieces to different jigsaw puzzles showing parts of the amber left eye of a Weimaraner, the green velvet folds of a gown, slate blue veining in a distant cloud, the orange nimbus of an explosion, perhaps a sunset, rivets in the skin of a flying fortress, the pink inner thigh of a pouting pinup girl, a few old weekly intelligence summaries from G2, a busted corkscrewing ukulele string, boxes of gummed paper stars in many colors, pieces of a flashlight topped to a nugget shoe polish can, in which Slothrop now and then studies his blurry brass reflection, any number of reference books out of the Achtung Library back down the hall, a dictionary of technical German, an F.O. special handbook or town plan, and usually, unless it's been pinched or thrown away, a News of the World, somewhere, too. Slothrop's a faithful reader. Tacked to the wall, next to Slothrop's desk, is a map of London, which Bloat is now busy photographing with his tiny camera. The musette bag is open, and the cubicle begins to fill with the smell of ripe bananas. Should he light a fag to cover this? Air doesn't exactly stir in here, they'll know someone's been in. It takes him four exposures, click, zippity, click. My, how very efficient at this he's become. Anyone nips in, one simply drops camera into bag, where banana sandwich cushions fall, telltale sound and harmful G-loads alike. Too bad whoever's funding this little paper won't spring for color film. Bloat wonders if it mightn't make a difference, though he knows of no one he can ask. The stars pasted up on Slothrop's map cover the available spectrum, beginning with silver, labeled Darlene, sharing a constellation with Gladys, green, and Catherine, gold, and as the eye strays, Alice, Dolores, Shirley, a couple of Sallys, mostly red and blue, through here, a cluster near Tower Hill, of violet density about Covent Garden, a nebula streaming on into Mayfair, Soho, and out to Wembley and up to Hampstead Heath. In every direction goes this glossy, multicolored, here and there peeling firmament, Caroline's, Maria's, Anne's, Susan's, Elizabeth's. But perhaps the colors are only random, uncoded. Perhaps the girls are not even real. From Tantivy, over weeks of casual questions, we know he's your schoolmate, but it's too risky bringing him in, Bloat's only able to report that Slothrop began work on this map last autumn, about the time he started going out to look at rocket bomb disasters for Achtung. having evidently the time in his travels among places of death to devote to girl chasing. If there's a reason for putting up the paper stars every few days, the man hasn't explained it. It doesn't seem to be for publicity. Tantivy's the only one who even glances at the map, and that's more in the spirit of an amiable anthropologist. Some sort of harmless Yank hobby, he tells his friend Bloat. Perhaps it's to keep track of them all. He does lead rather a complicated social life. Thereupon going into the story of Lorraine and Judy, Charles, the homosexual constable, and the piano in the Pantechnicon, or the bizarre masquerade involving Gloria and her newborn mother, a quid wager on the Blackpool-Preston North End game, a naughty version of Silent Night, and a providential fog. But none of these yarns, for the purposes of those Bloat reports to, are really very illuminating. Well, he's done now. Bag zipped, lamp off, and moved back in place. Perhaps there's time to catch Tantivy over at the Snipe and Shaft. Time for a comradely pint. He moves back down the beaverboard maze in the weak yellow light against a tide of incoming girls and galoshes. Aloof, Bloat, unsmiling, no time for slap and tickle here, you see. He still has his day's delivery to make. Wind has shifted around to the southwest, and the barometer's falling. The early afternoon is already dark as evening under the massing rain clouds. Tyrone Slothrop is going to be caught out in it, too. Today, it's been a long, idiot chase out to zero longitude, with the usual nothing to show. This one was supposed to be another premature airburst, the lumps of burning rocket showering down for miles around, most of it into the river, only one piece in any kind of shape, and that well surrounded by the time Slothrop arrived, with the tightest security he's seen yet, and the least friendly. Soft, faded berets against the slate clouds, Mark III stens set on automatic, mustaches mouth wide, covering enormous upper lips, humorless, no chance for any American lieutenant to get a look, not today. Achtung, anyhow, is the poor relative of Allied intelligence. At least this time Slothrop's not alone. He's had the cold comfort of seeing his opposite number from TI, and shortly after that even the man's section chief come fussing onto the scene in a 37 Wolseley Wasp, both turned back to. Ha, neither of them returning Slothrop's amiable nod. Tough shit, fellas. But shrewd Tyrone hangs around, distributing lucky strikes long enough to find at least what's up with this unlucky strike here. What it is a graphite cylinder, about 6 inches long and 2 in diameter, all but a few flakes of its army green paint charred away. Only piece that survived the burst. Evidently it was meant to. There seemed to be papers stashed inside. Sergeant Major burned his hand picking it up and was heard to holler, "Oh, fuck," causing laughter among the lower pay grades. Everybody was waiting around for a Captain Prentice from SOE. Those prickly bastards take their time about everything. Who does presently show up? Slothrop gets a glimpse, wind-burned face, big mean mother. Prentice takes the cylinder, drives away, and that's that. In which case, Slothrop reckons, Achtung can, a bit wearily, submit its 50 millionth interbranch request to that SOE asking for some report on the cylinder's contents and, as usual, be ignored. It's okay, he's not bitter. SOE ignores everybody, and everybody ignores Achtung. Hey, and what does it matter anyhow? It's his last rocket for a while, hopefully for good. This morning, in his in-basket, were orders sending him TDY some hospital out in the East End. No explanation beyond an attached carbon copy of a note to Achtung requesting his reassignment as part of the PWE testing program. Testing? PWE is Political Warfare Executive. He looked that up. Some more of that Minnesota multiphasic shit, no doubt, but it will be a change from this rocket-hunting routine, which is beginning to get a little old. Once upon a time, Slothrop cared. No kidding. He thinks he did, anyway. A lot of stuff prior to 1944 is getting blurry now. He can remember the first Blitz only as a long spell of good luck. Nothing that Luftwaffe dropped came near him. But this last summer, they started in with those buzz bombs. You'd be walking on the street, in bed, just dozing off, suddenly here comes this farting sound over the rooftops. If it just keeps on, rising to a peak and passing over, why, that's fine. Then it's somebody else's worry. But if the engine cuts off, look out, Jackson. It's begun its dive, sloshing the fuel aft away from the engine burner, and you've got 10 seconds to get under something. Well, it wasn't really too bad. After a while, you adjusted, found yourself making small bets, a shilling or two with Tantivy Mucker Maffick at the next desk about where the next doodle would hit. But then last September, the rockets came, them fucking rockets. You couldn't adjust to the bastards, no way. For the first time, he was surprised to find that he was really scared. Began drinking heavier, sleeping less, chain smoking, feeling in some way he'd been taken for a sucker. Christ, it wasn't supposed to keep on like this. I say, Slothrop, you've already got one in your mouth. Nervous, Slothrop, lighting up anyway. Well, not mine, Tant Ivy pleads. Two at a time, see? Making them point down like comic book fangs. The lieutenants stare at each other through the beery shadows, with the day deepening outside the high cold windows of the snipe and shaft, and Tant Ivy about to laugh or snort, oh God, across the wood Atlantic of their table. Atlantic's aplenty there have been these 3 years, often rougher than the one William, the first transatlantic Slothrop, crossed many ancestors ago. Barbarities of dress and speech, lapses in behavior, one horrible evening drunken Slothrop, Tant Ivy's guest at the Junior Athenaeum, got them both 86th, fainting with the beak of a stuffed owl after the jugular of the Coverley Pox, whilst Pox, at bay on a billiard table, attempted to ram a cue ball down Slothrop's throat. This sort of thing goes on dismayingly often. Yet kindness is a sturdy enough ship for these oceans, Tant Ivy always there, blushing or smiling, and Slothrop surprised at how, when it's really counted, Tant Ivy hasn't ever let him down. He knows he can spill what's on his mind. It hasn't much to do with today's amorous report on Norma, dimply Cedar Rapids sub-deb legs, Marjorie, tall, elegant, a build out of the chorus line at the windmill, and the strange events Saturday night at the Frick Frack Club in Soho, a haunt of low reputation with moving spotlights of many pastel hues, off-limits and no jitterbug dancing signs laid on to satisfy the many sorts of police, military, and civilian, whatever civilian means nowadays, who look in from time to time, and were against all chance, through some horrible secret plot, Slothrop, who was to meet one, walks in, sees who but both lined up in a row, the angle deliberately just for him, over the blue wool shoulder of an engineman third class under the bare lovely armpit of a lindy-hopping girl, swung and posed, skin-stained lavender by the shifting light just there, and then, paranoia flooding up, the two faces beginning to turn his way. Both young ladies happen to be silver stars on Slothrop's map. He must have been feeling silvery both times, shiny, jingling. The stars he pastes up are colored only to go with how he feels that day, blue on up to golden. Never to rank a single one, how can he? Nobody sees the map but Tant Ivy and Christ, they're all beautiful. In leaf or flower around his wintering city, in tea shops, in the queues, babushkaed and coat-wrapped, sighing, sneezing, all lisle legs on the curbstones, hitchhiking, typing, or filing with pompadours sprouting yellow pencils, he finds them. Dames, tomatoes, sweater girls. Yes, it is a little obsessive, maybe, but I know there is wild love and joy enough in the world, preached Thomas Hooker, as there are wild thyme and other herbs, but we would have garden love and garden joy of God's own planting. How Slothrop's garden grows, teems with virgin's bower, with forget-me-nots, with rue, and all over the place, purple and yellow as hickeys, a prevalence of love in idleness. He likes to tell them about fireflies. English girls don't know about fireflies, which is about all Slothrop knows for sure about English girls. The map does puzzle Tant Ivy. It cannot be put down to the usual loud-mouthed American ass-banditry, except as a fraternity boy reflex in a vacuum. A reflex Slothrop can't help, barking on into an empty lab, into a wormholing of echoing hallways, long after the need has vanished and the brothers gone to World War II and their chances for death. Slothrop really doesn't like to talk about his girls. Tant Ivy has to steer him diplomatically even now. At first, Slothrop, quaintly gentlemanly, didn't talk at all, till he found out how shy Tant Ivy was. It dawned on him then that Tant Ivy was looking to be fixed up. At about the same time, Tant Ivy began to see the extent of Slothrop's isolation. He seemed to have no one else in London beyond a multitude of girls he seldom saw again to talk to about anything. Still, Slothrop keeps his map up daily, boobishly conscientious. At its best, it does celebrate a flow, a passing from which, among the sudden demolitions from the sky, mysterious orders arriving out of the dark laborings of nights that for himself are only idle, he can save a moment here or there, the days again growing colder, frost in the morning, the feeling of Jennifer's breasts inside cold sweaters, wool held to warm a bit in a coal smoke hallway he'll never know the daytime despondency of, cup of Bovril a fraction down from boiling, searing his bare knee as Irene, naked as he is in a block of glass sunlight, holds up precious nylons one by one to find a pair that hasn't laddered, each struck flashing by the light through the winter trellis outside. Nasal, hep American girl voices singing out of the grooves of some disc up through the thorn needle of Allison's mother's radiogram, snuggling for warmth. Blackout curtains over all the windows, no light but the coal of their last cigarette, an English firefly, bobbing at her whim in cursive writing that trails a bit behind, words he can't read. What happened? Silence from Slothrop. Your two wrens, when they saw you. Then he notices that Slothrop, instead of going on with his story, has given himself up to shivering. Has been shivering, in fact, for some time. It's cold in here, but not that cold. Slothrop...
I don't know. Jesus.
It's interesting, though. It's the weirdest feeling. He can't stop. He turns his Ike jacket collar up, tucks hands inside sleeves, and sits that way for a while. Presently, after a pause, cigarette in motion.
You can't hear them when they come in.
Tent Ivy knows which they. His eyes shift away. There is silence for a bit. Of course you can't. They go faster than sound.
Yes, but that's not it.
Words are bursting up between the pulses of shivering.
The other kind. Those V1s. You can hear them, right? Maybe you have a chance to get out of the way, but these things explode first. And then you hear them coming in. Except that if you're dead, you don't hear them.
Same in the infantry. You know that. You never hear the one that gets you.
But think of it as a very large bullet, Slothrop, with fins. Jesus.
Teeth chattering.
You're such a comfort.
Tant Ivy, leaning anxiously through the smell of hops and the brown gloom, more worried now about Slothrop's shaking than any specter of his own, has nothing but established channels he happens to know of to try and conjure it away. Why not see if we can get you out to where some of them have hit?
What for? Come on, Tant Ivy, they're completely destroyed, aren't they?
I don't know. I doubt even the Germans know, but it's the best chance we'll have to one-up that lot over in TI, isn't it? Which is how Slothrop got into investigating V-bomb incidents, aftermaths. Each morning, at first, someone in civil defense routed, Achtung, a list of yesterday's hits. It would come round to Slothrop last. He'd detach its pencil-smeared buck slip, go draw the same aging Humber from the motor pool, and make his rounds. A St. George after the fact, going out to poke about for droppings of the beast, fragments of German hardware that wouldn't exist, writing empty summaries into his notebooks, work therapy. As inputs to Achtung got faster, often he'd show up in time to help the search crews, following restless-muscled RAF dogs into the plaster smell, the gas leaking, the leaning long splinters and sagging mesh, the prone and noseless caryatids, rust already at nails and naked thread surfaces, the powdery wipe of nothing's hand across wallpaper, a whisper with peacocks spreading their fans down deep lawns to Georgian houses long ago, to safe groves of home oak. Among the calls for silence following to where some exposed hand or brightness of skin waited them, survivor or casualty. When he couldn't help, he stayed clear, praying, at first, conventionally, to God, first time since the other blitz, for life to win out. But too many were dying, and presently, seeing no point, he stopped. Yesterday happened to be a good day. They found a child, alive, a little girl half-suffocated under a Morrison shelter. Waiting for the stretcher, Slothrop held her small hand, gone purple with the cold. Dogs barked in the street. When she opened her eyes and saw him, her first words were, "Any gum, chum?" Trapped there for 2 days, gumless, All he had for her was a Thayer's slippery elm. He felt like an idiot. Before they took her off, she brought his hand over to kiss anyway, her mouth and cheek in the flare lamps cold as frost. The city around them at once a big, desolate icebox, stale smelling and no surprises inside ever again. At which point she smiled very faintly, and he knew that's what he'd been waiting for. Wow, a Shirley Temple smile, as if this exactly canceled all they'd found her down in the middle of. What a damn fool thing. He hangs at the bottom of his blood's avalanche, 300 years of Western Swamp Yankees, and can't manage but some nervous truce with their providence. A detente. Ruins he goes daily to look in are each a sermon on vanity. That he finds, as weeks wear on, no least fragment of any rocket, preaches how indivisible is the act of death. Slothrop's progress. London, the secular city, instructs him, turn any corner, and he can find himself inside a parable. He has become obsessed with the idea of a rocket with his name written on it. If they're really set on getting him, they embracing possibilities far, far beyond Nazi Germany. That's the surest way. Doesn't cost them a thing to paint his name on every one, right? Yes, well, that can be useful. Can't I be watching him funny? Can't it? Especially in combat to, you know, pretend something like that. Jolly useful. Call it operational paranoia or something, but who's pretending? Lighting a cigarette, shaking his forelock through the smoke. Jeepers, Aunt Ivy, listen, I don't want to upset you, but, I mean, I'm 4 years overdue is what it is. It could happen any time, the next second, right? Just suddenly, shit, just zero, just nothing, and... It's nothing he can see or lay hands on. Sudden gases, a violence upon the air and no trace afterward. A word spoken with no warning into your ear and then silence forever. Beyond its invisibility, beyond hammerfall and doomcrack, here is its real horror, mocking, promising him death with German and precise confidence, laughing down all of Tantivy's quiet decencies. No, no bullet with fins, Ace. Not the word, the one word that rips apart the day. It was Friday evening last September, just off work, heading for the Bond Street underground station. His mind on the weekend ahead and his two wrens, that Norma and that Marjorie, whom he must each keep from learning about the other, just as he was reaching to pick his nose, suddenly in the sky, miles behind his back and up the river, memento mori, a sharp crack and a heavy explosion, rolling right behind, almost like a clap of thunder. But not quite. Seconds later, this time from in front of him, it happened again, loud and clear all over the city, bracketed, not a buzz bomb. Not that Luftwaffe, not thunder either, he puzzled out loud. Some bloody gas main, a lady with a lunchbox, puppy-eyed from the day, elbowing him in the back as she passed. No, it's the Germans, her friend with rolled blonde fringes under a checked kerchief, doing some monster routine here, raising her hands at Slothrop. Coming to get him. They especially love fat, plump Americans. In a minute she'll be reaching out to pinch his cheek and wobble it back and forth. Hi, Glamour Puss, Slothrop said. Her name was Cynthia. He managed to get a telephone number before she was waving ta-ta, born again into the rush-hour crowds. It was one of those great iron afternoons in London, the yellow sun being teased apart by a thousand chimneys breathing, fawning upward without shame. This smoke is more than the day's breath, more than dark strength. It is an imperial presence that lives and moves. People were crossing the streets and squares, going everywhere. Buses were grinding off, hundreds of them, down the long concrete viaducts, smeared with years' pitiless use and no pleasure, into haze-gray, grease-black, red-lead and pale aluminum, between scrap heaps that towered high as blocks of flats, down side-shoving curves into roads clogged with army convoys, other tall buses and canvas lorries, bicycles and cars, everyone here with different destinations and beginnings, all flowing, hitching now and then, over it all the enormous gas ruin of the sun among the smokestacks, the barrage balloons, power lines and chimneys brown as aging indoor wood, brown growing deeper, approaching black through an instant, perhaps the true turn of the sunset that is wine to you, wine and comfort. The moment was 6:43:16, British double summer time. the sky beaten like death's drum, still humming, and Slothrop's cock. Say what? Yes, look at inside his GI undershorts. Here's a sneaky hard-on stirring, ready to jump. Well, great God, where'd that come from? There is in his history, and likely, God help him, in his dossier, a peculiar sensitivity to what is revealed in the sky. But a hard-on? On the old schist of a tombstone in the Congregational churchyard back home in Minnesboro, Massachusetts, the hand of God emerges from a cloud, the edges of the figure here and there eroded by 200 years of seasons, fire, and ice chiseled at work, and the inscription reading, "In memory of Constant Slothrop, who died March 4, 1766, in the 29th year of his age. Death is a debt to nature due, which I have paid, and so must you." Constant saw, and not only with his heart, that stone hand pointing out of the secular clouds, pointing directly at him, its edges traced in unbearable light above the whispering of his river and slopes of his long blue Berkshires, as would his son Variable Slothrop, indeed all of the Slothrop blood one way or another, the 9 or 10 generations tumbling back, branching inward, every one except for William, the very first, lying under fallen leaves, mint and purple loosestrife, chilly elm and willow shadows over the swamp edge graveyard in a long gradient of rot, leaching, assimilation with the earth, the stones showing round-faced angels with the long noses of dogs, toothy and deep-socketed death's heads, Masonic emblems, flowery urns, feathery willows upright and broken, exhausted hourglasses, sun faces about to rise or set with eyes peeking Kilroy style over the horizon, and memorial verse running from straight on and four square as for Constant Slothrop through bouncy star-spangled banner meter for Mrs. Elizabeth, wife of Lieutenant Isaiah Slothrop, died 1812. Adieu, my dear friends, I have come to this grave where insatiate death in his reaping hath brought me. Till Christ rise again, all his children to save, I must lie as his word in the scriptures hath taught me. Mark, reader, my cry, bend thy thoughts on the sky, and in midst of prosperity know thou mayest die, while the great loom of God works in darkness above, and our trials here below are but threads of his love. To the current Slothrop's grandfather, Frederick, died 1933, who in typical sarcasm and guile bagged his epitaph from Emily Dickinson without a credit line. Because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me. Each one, in turn, paying his debt to nature due, and leaving the excess to the next link in the name's chain. They began as fur traders, cordwainers, salters, and smokers of bacon, went on into glass-making, became selectmen, builders of tanneries, quarriers of marble. Country for miles around gone to necropolis, gray with marble dust, dust that was the breaths, the ghosts of all those fake Athenian monuments going up elsewhere across the Republic. Always elsewhere. The money seeping its way out through stock portfolios more intricate than any genealogy. What stayed at home in Berkshire went into timberland, whose diminishing green reaches were converted acres at a clip into paper, toilet paper, banknote stock, newsprint, a medium or ground for shit, money, and the word. They were not aristocrats. No Slothrop ever made it into the social register or the Somerset Club. They carried on their enterprise in silence, assimilated in life to the dynamic that surrounded them thoroughly as in death they would be to churchyard earth. Shit, money, and the word. The three American truths, powering the American mobility, claimed the Slothrops, clasped them for good to the country's fate. But they did not prosper. About all they did was persist. Though it all began to go sour for them around the time Emily Dickinson, never far away, was writing, "Ruin is formal devil's work, consecutive and slow. Fail in an instant, no man did. Slipping is crash's law." Still, they would keep on. The tradition for others was clear, everyone knew. Mine it out, work it, take all you can till it's gone, then move on west. There's plenty more. But out of some reasoned inertia, the Slothrops stayed east in Berkshire, perverse, close to the flooded quarries and logged-off hillsides they'd left like signed confessions across all that thatchy brown, moldering witch country. The profits slackening, the family ever multiplying. Interest from various numbered trusts was still turned by family banks down in Boston every second or third generation back into yet another trust in long rallentando, in infinite series, just perceptibly, term by term, dying, but never quite to the zero. The Depression, by the time it came, ratified what had been underway. Slothrop grew up in a hilltop desolation of businesses going under. Hedges around the estates of the vastly rich, half-mythical cottagers from New York, lapsing back now to green wilderness or straw death, all the crystal windows, every single one smashed, Harriman's and Whitney's gone, lawns growing to hay, and the autumn's no longer a time for foxtrots in the distances, limousines and lamps, but only the accustomed crickets again, apples again, early frosts to send the hummingbirds away, east wind, October rain, only winter certainties. In 1931, the year of the great Aspinwall Hotel fire, young Tyrone was visiting his aunt and uncle in Lenox. It was in April, but for a second or two as he was coming awake in the strange room and the racket of big and little cousins' feet down the stairs, he thought of winter, because so often he'd been wakened like this, at this hour of sleep, by Pop or Hogan, bundled outside, still blinking through an overlay of dream into the cold, to watch the northern lights. They scared the shit out of him. Were the radiant curtains just about to swing open? What would the ghosts of the north in their finery have to show him? But this was a spring night, and the sky was gusting red, warm orange. The sirens howling in the valleys from Pittsfield, Lenox, and Lee, neighbors stood out on their porches to stare up at the shower of sparks falling down on the mountainside. Like a meteor shower, they said, like cinders from the 4th of July. It was 1931, and those were the comparisons. The embers fell on and on for 5 hours, while kids dozed and grown-ups got to drink coffee and tell fire stories from other years. But what lights were these? What ghosts in command? And suppose, in the next moment, all of it, the complete night, were to go out of control and curtains part to show us a winter no one has guessed at? 6:43:16 BDST. In the sky right now, here is the same unfolding, just about to break through, his face deepening with its light, everything about to rush away and he to lose himself just as his countryside has ever proclaimed. Slender church steeples poised up and down, all these autumn hillsides, white rockets about to fire, only seconds of countdown away, rose windows taking in Sunday light, elevating and washing the faces above the pulpits, defining grace, swearing this is how it does happen. Yes, the great bright hand reaching out of the cloud. On the wall, in an ornate fixture of darkening bronze, a gas jet burns, laminar and gently singing, adjusted to what scientists of the last century called a sensitive flame. Invisible at the base as it issues from its orifice, fading upward into smooth blue light that hovers several inches above, a glimmering small cone that can respond to the most delicate changes in the room's air pressure. It registers visitors as they enter and leave, each curious and civil as if the round table held some game of chance. The circle of sitters is not at all distracted or hindered, none of your white hands or luminous trumpets here. Cameron's officers in parade trews, blue puttees, dress kilts drift in, conversing with enlisted Americans. There are clergymen, home guard or fire service just off duty, folds of wool clothing heavy with smoke smell, everyone grudging an hour's sleep and looking it. Ancient Edwardian ladies in crepe de chine, West Indians softly plaiting vowels round less flexible chains of Russian Jewish consonants. Most skate tangent to the holy circle. Some stay, some are off again to other rooms, all without breaking in on the slender medium who sits nearest the sensitive flame with his back to the wall, reddish-brown curls tightening close as a skullcap, high forehead unwrinkled, dark lips moving, now effortless, now in pain. Once transected into the realm of Dominus Placero, Roland found that all the signs had turned against him. Lights he had studied so well as one of you, position and movement, now gathered there at the opposite end, all in dance, irrelevant dance. None of Glicero's traditional progress, no something new, alien. Roland, too, became conscious of the wind, as his mortality had never allowed him, discovered it so joyful that the arrow must veer into it. The wind had been blowing all year long, year after year. But Roland had felt only the secular wind. He means only his personal wind. Yet, Selina, the wind's everywhere. Here the medium breaks off, is silent a while. One groan, a quiet, desperate moment. Selina, Selina, have you gone then? No, my dear, her cheeks mottled with previous tears. I'm listening. It's control. All these things arise from one difficulty, control. For the first time it was inside, do you see? The control is put inside. No more need to suffer passively under outside forces, to veer into any wind, as if a market needed no longer be run by the invisible hand, but now could create itself, its own logic, momentum, style, from inside. Putting the control inside was ratifying what de facto had happened, that you had dispensed with God. But you had taken on a greater and more harmful illusion, the illusion of control, that A could do B. But that was false, completely. No one can do. Things only happen. A and B are unreal, are names for parts that ought to be inseparable. More Uspenskayan nonsense, whispers a lady brushing by on the arm of a dock worker. Odors of diesel fuel and soulevant mingle as they pass. Jessica Swanlake, a young rosy girl in the uniform of an ATS private, noticing the pre-war perfume, looks up. The frock, she imagines, is about 15 guineas, and who knows how many coupons, probably from Harrods, and would do more for me, she's also sure. The lady, suddenly looking back over her shoulder, smiles. Oh, yes? My gosh, did she hear? Around this place, almost certainly. Jessica's been standing near the seance table with a handful of darts idly plucked from the board on the wall, her head bent, pale nape and top vertebra visible above the brown wool collar, and through some of her lighter brown hair fallen either side along her cheeks. Brass throats and breasts warm to her blood quake in the hollow of her hand. She seems herself, gentling their feathered crosses, brushing with fingertips, to have slid into a shallow trance. Outside, rolling from the east, comes the muffled rip of another rocket bomb. The windows rattle, the floor shakes. The sensitive flame dives for shelter. Shadows across the table scent a dance, darkening toward the other room. Then it leaps high, the shadows drawing inward again, fully 2 feet, and disappears completely. Gas hisses on in the dim room. Milton Gloaming, who achieved perfect tripos at Cambridge 10 years ago, abandons his shorthand to rise and go shut the gas off. It seems the right moment now for Jessica to throw a dart. One dart. Hair swinging, breasts bobbing marvelously beneath each heavy wool lapel. A hiss of air, whack, into the sticky fibers, into the dead center. Milton Gloaming cocks an eyebrow. His mind, always gathering correspondences, thinks it has found a new one. The medium, irritable now, has begun to drift back out of his trance. Anybody's guess what's happening over on the other side. This sitting, like any, needs not only its congenial circle here and secular, but also a basic four-way entente which oughtn't any link of it to be broken. Roland Feldspath, the spirit. Peter Saxa, the control. Carol Eventer, the medium. Selina, the wife and survivor. Somewhere, through exhaustion, redirection, gusts of white noise out in the ether, this arrangement has begun now to dissolve. Relaxation, chairs squeaking, sighs and throat clearings. Milton Gloaming fusses with his notebook, shuts it abruptly. Presently Jessica comes wandering over, no sign of Roger, and she's not sure he wants her to come looking for him. And Gloaming, though shy, isn't as horrid as some of Roger's other friends.
Roger says that now you count up all those words you copied and graph them or something, brightly, to head off any comment on the dart incident, which she'd rather avoid. Do you do it only for seances? Automatic texts. Girl nervous, gloaming, frowns, nods. One or two Ouija board episodes, yes, yes. We're trying to develop a vocabulary of curves, certain pathologies, certain characteristic shapes, you see. I'm not sure that I... Well, recall Zipf's principle of least effort. If we plot the frequency of a word P sub N against its rank order N on logarithmic axes, babbling into her silence, even her bewilderment graceful, we should, of course, get something like a straight line. However, we've data that suggest the curves for certain conditions. Well, they're actually quite different. Schizophrenics, for example, tend to run a bit flatter in the upper part, then progressively steeper, a sort of bow shape. I think with this chap, this Roland, that we're onto a classical paranoiac. Ha! Ah, that's a word she knows. Thought I saw you brighten up there when he said turned against. Against? Opposite, yes, you'd be amazed at the frequency with this one. What's the most frequent word, asks Jessica. You're number one. The same as it's always been at these affairs, replies the statistician as if everyone knew, death. An elderly air raid warden, starchy and frail as organdy, stands on tiptoe to relight the sensitive flame. Incidentally, where's your mad young gentleman gone off to? Rogers with Captain Prentice, waving vaguely. The usual mysterious microfilm drill. Being transacted in some distant room across a crown and anchor game with which chance has very little to do, billows of smoke and chatter, Falkman and his Apache band subdued over the BBC, chunky pints and slender sherry glasses, winter rain at the windows. Time for closeting, gas logs, shawls against the cold night, snug with your young lady or old Dutch or, as here at Snoxall's, in good company. Here's a shelter, perhaps a real node of tranquility among several scattered throughout this long wartime, where they're gathering for purposes not entirely in the martial interest. Pirate Prentice feels something of this, obliquely, by way of class nervousness, really. He bears his grin among these people here like a phalanx. He learned it at the films. It is the exact mischievous Irish grin your Dennis Morgan chap goes about cocking down at the black smoke vomiting from each and every little buck-toothed yellow rat he shoots down. It's as useful to him as he is to the firm, who, it is well known, will use anyone, traitors, murderers, perverts, negroes, even women, to get what they want. They may not have been that sure of pirates' usefulness at first, but later, as it developed, they were to grow very sure indeed. Major General, you can't actually give your support to this. We're watching him around the clock. He certainly isn't leaving the premises physically. Then he has a confederate. Somehow, hypnosis, drugs, I don't know, they're getting to his man and tranquilizing him. For God's sake, next you'll be consulting horoscopes. Hitler does. Hitler is an inspired man, but you and I are employees, remember? After that first surge of interest, the number of clients assigned to Pirate tapered off some. At the moment, he carries what he feels is a comfortable caseload. But it's not what he really wants. End of side one. To continue, turn the cassette over.